Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Slay in Your Lane, the podcast. I'm Elizabeth Ifebenene.
And my name's Yomi Edegeke.
So this week, it's been such a weird week. I think for a lot of people receiving A-levels. So I think we're going to talk about that later on and some other bits and bobs. But first and foremost, how's your week been, Yomi?
Yeah, it doesn't really feel like it's been. Like, I feel like, God, I mean, there was some stress yesterday. Like, oh God, there's always some sort of work thing going on. That feels almost more stressful than it does like outside of a pandemic, because obviously alongside trying to like not catch coronavirus or like be killed by like the pending or like current recession, yeah, there's like work stuff on top of it, which just feels like simultaneously a stupid thing to fret about with everything else that's going on, but also like just more stressful than ever. So yeah, I feel like every, for the past like however many weeks we've been recording, I feel like there's always some dramatic work related like shit going on, but yeah, I think just this very minute it might have died down a bit, so feeling cautiously optimistic. How's your week been?
Yeah, I think like it's weird because I think everybody must be like, you guys just speaking code in at the start of your episode. I think it's just been, I think the heat wave of last week was just one of those things that I just found it really hard to kind of concentrate or do anything. So I'm so happy that the weather isn't, you know, massively rainy and all of that sort of stuff, but it's cooled down massively. I think that was just stressing me out last week. It's just, yeah, I don't think our country and just the way we are in this country is built for a heat wave. A heat wave of like a day, okay, maybe 2 days, but I cannot do a week. Like, it's just a bit mad.
The UK is not built for anything other than drizzle. Like, if it's snow, it can't cope. If it's really hot, it can't cope. It's literally just like the April showers. That's what we're built to do here. Beyond that, it's just like catastrophe
for sure. So our first topic of the day was something that was getting me really stressed last week and just really just like demoralized even further. and it was the whole A-level scandal. So it's weird because we've, as of like us recording today, like a couple of hours ago, was it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday, the government's made a U-turn. But long story short, yesterday, the government made a U-turn on their highly controversial decision to downgrade almost 40% of A-level results in England after, you know, a widespread outcry and student protest, essentially. So I'm trying to not inject my own personal opinion in this, as I told you guys. But Ofqual, this stupid thing, which is basically, it's an exam regulation who has downgraded, who created this algorithm, which is essentially very biased and has downgraded a lot of students and things like that. So it is just, I don't know, like this class of 2020, I just feel really sorry for them for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, man, it's mad because like, I mean, to be honest, I was absolutely convinced and certain that they'd U-turn. I was like, come on, like there's absolutely no way. Like it's like, I was saying to my little sister, it's giving me, what's the word, Charles Dickens, Dickensian levels of cruelty. I was like, come on, this is actually like caricature level, like Margaret Thatcher stealing the milk, the Grinch who stole, like Christmas is cancelled level, like cruelty. Oh, we're going to like, you know, decide children's grades based on an algorithm that's going to like cut their grade by like 50. I was just like, they can't stick to this, because obviously this government has been like cartoonishly cruel throughout the coronavirus crisis. Like the fact that we've got, it's not even funny, but like the fact that we've been punished I don't know why I'm saying our handling of the coronavirus scandal, and it's literally Boris Johnson's like handling of the coronavirus like crisis, like with like the one of the worst death rates in the world, with like one of the worst recessions in Europe. Like I think this government has just been like, yeah, like almost like sketch show level villain, pantomime villain level bad. That's why I was like, surely this would just be like, honestly, the final nail in like a literal like horror film coffin. And then, yeah, of course they U-turned, because obviously Scotland U-turned as well. So I couldn't tell surprised, but that kind of run up, I was talking to my, it's so weird calling her mentee, because like technically she's my mentee. Like I met her when she was 15 and I was like 21. And she was working on a magazine that I used to, you know the story anyway, Elizabeth, but like birthday magazine. So literally like I met her then, but like obviously now we're like closer in age and we're friends. And I remember like, you know, she was a very, very talented, like literal prodigy, child genius type. That was like really like had very serious mitigating circumstances that led to her getting into Cambridge, I think twice, if not three times. And then them basically not really taking her mitigating circumstances into account, which meant that she wasn't able to go, even though she was only like, I think, very mildly below the grades that she was predicted. So I feel like we were having a conversation about yesterday and it was just like this whole situation. It's actually really sad on so many levels, because this isn't the first time by any means that like young people, especially from disadvantaged backgrounds, have been let down by the system. Yes, it's almost like a cartoon in this state, in this specific instance, where it's like, oh, we're gonna literally get an algorithm and a computer to decide which of you ones gets to thrive in life. But with her situation and so many other situations like that, where like mitigating circumstances aren't taken into account, where like things like the postcode lottery, all these things, like they have pre-existed like the coronavirus crisis, gosh, that's actually a really hard phrase to say, for years. And it's just like the first time in a long time that we're actually really having these conversations about how the system is essentially rigged to stop certain people from thriving within it. And it's now we're having this conversation, but it's sad because this isn't by any means the first time. How did you feel, especially because you've got younger siblings?
Yeah, but I wouldn't say I'm lucky, because my sister isn't doing her GCSEs till next year. So I guess I didn't feel it personally from that point of view, but I felt it very personal, just because I think for me, when I was 16, and education was like my ticket to basically, I wouldn't say better myself, but improve my life chances. And that's what education is meant to do. Like when you're younger, you're told if you put the work in, like all of that sort of stuff, you will go somewhere. Like this, you're like, even when you're growing up in a Nigerian household, like education is a really big thing. So I think for me, it just gave me really bad PTSD, like if that's the right term. Like
that's what she was saying, war flashbacks, yeah.
Oh my God, yeah, that's exactly how it felt, because I just couldn't imagine that feeling like that. So, and I think that was just my main thing. I was just like, education for someone, if you come from a particular background, it's very few things that, you know, that can kind of, I'm not about, oh my God, lift you out of poverty and all that sort of stuff, but like, the promise of bettering your circumstances is, you know, kind of, you use education to do that as a tool. So when we saw a system that, and I think what you said around basically like the fact that it just exposes the privileges that we all see every single day, we've all gone through the state education system and we see like the disparity and all of that sort of stuff. And like, I don't know, I was saying to somebody that sometimes you grow up thinking that private school kids are smarter than you, and like, because, you know, they it's just, you know, this whole style of all of that sort of stuff. And you kind of like, you become an adult later on in life and you realize like, it's just privilege, like being able to talk in a particular type of way, have the connections, all of that sort of stuff. It just exposes, and I've always been kind of on the fence about this, like not on the fence, I've always been kind of like, I'm not really a private, I'm kind of against, you know, the concept of private schools and all that sort of stuff. But personally, depending on my life, I'm not sure, I don't want to be like, I'm not sending my child to private school. I've always been kind of, but last week I was just like, I would struggle to do that. So I don't know, last week was just, I guess, confirmed a lot of the feelings I have around like private schools, and it's not personal to people who go to private schools, it's because, you know, you don't have a choice on what your parents send you. But I think the privileges that it bestows on people who enter that system is something that I just cannot morally, like, come to terms with in this country. And it's a myth of meritocracy. It's just, there are so many things about the education system in this country that is rigged against you if you're working class, if you're black, all of these things. And so I think that's, I felt really demoralized last week but then hearing, obviously, the U-turn was quite good to hear that. But yeah, I think it just confirmed that we live in a very, very privileged, there's no such society, there's no such thing as meritocracy. I, for a long time, believed in that. But I think over the last, I'd say, 5 years, I just realised that that's not the case. The cream does not always rise to the top. The people who are in positions of power in this country are not there because they're the smartest. And do you know what's so funny? You know, like Gavin Williamson guy, him, he was just like, we don't want to basically, like, inflate grades because we don't want a culture of people who are incompetent at their jobs, sort of thing. Do you know how like crazy that is to say? That means that's somebody who doesn't understand the job market, because there are already too many people going to university who are very much overqualified. He doesn't understand the skills market in this country. For you to say that, I think my brain was melting physically last week because of the heat, but also mentally because I just genuinely didn't understand, like, the idiots that essentially have power to kind of govern and control. So yeah, that was kind of like, I guess, really hard. And I don't know, like, what would you say your, because yeah, would you say your A level, because now it's going to be done via teachers' predicted grades. How, if you were in the system, A level, how would you have fared? If, you know, if you were,
I would have. I'm one of those people that's going to be like, well, actually, I would have I would have got into where I was going. I got exactly my predicted grades.
Yeah.
But I mean, I still don't think it's fair. Like, and again, I've always said that's the thing. I think I got what I was predicted, but I also understood from a very early age, and I've said this a million times on a million different podcasts, that even that in and of itself, I've never ever felt that it was representative of much more than the fact that I knew what I needed to write to get a particular grade. For instance, like, I was rubbish at maths. I've already said that I was, like, in the second bottom set for maths, which led to mass confusion because I'd managed to fool everybody for years into thinking that I was smarter than I was. But, like, in terms of, like, in terms of, what is it, English and, like, history and sociology and, like, I can't remember what subjects I did, but, like, at the end of the day, I was very much like, okay, like, I was very good at, like, cramming, and I was very good at understanding what I needed to say in terms of what to, I was very good at knowing what I needed to say to be able to secure particular grades. And to me, that's never, even back then, I was like, I'd say smart enough to know that that wasn't real intelligence. Because, like, I'm would
just
never
cramming,
say that.
Isn't
not,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
You're smart, but you know,
I am smart, but I'm more street smart in terms of knowing what I needed to write and what I needed to say. And there's so many different types of intellect which continue to go under the radar and continue not to be detected because we are so fixated on people getting, like, you know, basically being able to remember 1066 and put it on a paper. Like, that's what we're focused on. And it's harder to do that, to be fair, with, like, maths and stuff, which is why I couldn't scam my way through, like, the math system. But I could definitely scam my way in English, English, history, you know, sociology, RE, all those kind of topics that would just require you to remember things and answer remember what your teacher in particular wanted you to say, even if you didn't agree with it. Like, that was kind of like what it was. But, like, but what's interesting is, yeah, whilst I'd have been fine because I, like, also was very strategic with the subjects that I picked, which meant that I was like, yeah, like, I had, like, shown continually that I'd be okay in those areas. A lot of people that I know did much better than they were predicted. In fact, a lot of people went up at least 2 grades above what they were predicted. So I know a lot of people wouldn't have fared as well. And I think, again, even the fact that it's like, oh, okay, like, I don't know. I still think that even if, you know, even aside from that issue, there's also a very big issue in terms of it being like, you know, maybe this should make us really radically rethink university as a signifier of intellect, of educational prestige and stuff like that, because at the end of the day, you know, I've seen all these companies being like, oh, we're going to stop like recruiting from universities, or we're going to stop requiring degree as a like entry point in terms of a job. And I'm like, yeah, because really and truly, like, for years, aside from this scandal, we have allowed like lots of different types of intellect and talent to fly under the radar because we're too busy being like, oh, we need to ensure that Tristan from, you know, Eton gets his job at Daddy's wherever, like, and but we just had this like whole factory of the same people because they've all basically learned how to, not even learned really, they've just been, their parents have paid for them to learn how to end up in particular spaces and places, which is why we end up with the government that we have now. But how about you? How would you
basically think? No, I think honestly exactly the same as you, like genuinely, like I would have, I got, my predicted grades were very much great, like A star, it was great. So I would have totally been fine. And I was telling someone this story that when I didn't do my, so when I was, my GCSE, I didn't do my GCSE media studies grade exam because I had like a weird tooth that flared up and I had to go to like last minute surgery. It was weird. And then I turned up because I was like, I can't miss my GCSE exam for media studies. I turned up on the day to my school, still drugged up, but I was like, no, I have to go in. So I turned up and my mouth was all like, literally like, I can't even, like it was swollen so much. And then the teacher asked me, they were like, we can either give you your predicted grade because you can sit the exam. My predicted grade was an A star. So of course I was going to say, I'm going to not sit this exam. So I went home. Do you know what I mean? So like predicted grades, if your predicted grades are, it's like, how can I get better than A star? Like, of course I was going to always go home. But I wanted to show that I was willing to do it because you just never know, innit. So predicted grades are good when, you know, your teacher likes you, teacher sees your potential. You've done well throughout the year. Your mock exams are like on par, but they're not good if you basically like have had issues at home, or like you've had, like there are things that are external forces at play. We don't just sit exams and you know, go to school and that's it. There are things at play, which mean that, you know, you cannot always give yourself 100, you cannot always give your education or a particular mock exam everything you'd want to give it for the real thing. So I would have been fine in my A-levels, and yeah, I would have been fine. But I just, like you said, I know people use their real grades to really elevate themselves and really prove themselves. And like you said about the saying things to get by, that is, I got that realization when I was 16 and I went, oh my God. I remember my A-levels, everybody was banging out five subjects for politics, like learning all the different five subjects, topics inside out, because out of those five subjects and there's three questions that come out. I took a risk. I said, I'm not learning all those five subjects. I'm going to only learn, I think I only learned like three, and then did like a backup four. Like, and I literally was just so strategic. So whatever question I would have, that came up, I had to answer it. But I knew that if I learned everything about it, I would have been fine. And I was fine but that's a risk. And I think strategically, that's how I kind of play the system, like over the years, like up until like even degree level.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's a question I actually wanted to bring up, actually, about what you were saying around, like, intelligence and what is the marker, university and exams and stuff like that. So what we found is a lot of companies over the years, so, you know, EY, KPMG, a lot of these professional service companies have kind of like changed their grad programs to not include A-levels and things like that. So they're kind of like widening the spectrum of what they look for in candidates, because even if you find that disadvantage and bias is into the system even before like your GCSEs and stuff like that. So they're kind of like, for more, you know, better hiring practices, they're kind of doing away, putting less prominence on A-levels and all of that sort of stuff. So I was having this debate with somebody and they're like, that's a good thing. All of this stuff is a good thing. And I agree. But how do we then determine who gets a job? Because it is still needs to be competitive. And what you find is how companies hire, when they take away qualifications and stuff like that, I don't necessarily believe it then means that the hiring practices are therefore even like are become not biased. I still feel like bias is still at play, because it then becomes likability. Do you know what I mean? Like, all of this stuff becomes less prominent, like the kind of likability. And that's where black, you know, all of this stuff, like racism becomes a play, sexism becomes, you know, like even more at play, all of this types of stuff. So I don't have the answers, and obviously, bruv, it's way above my pay grade, but I don't know what do you think about that? Because I don't think that in itself is the way we need to go. I'm still unsure, because ultimately likability, where like still, and then who wins the likability contest? It ain't gonna be me. It's gonna be a very charming white boy who can, do you know what I mean? Mm. Like the likelihood is, so I don't know. I'm not sure, but I don't know.
I hear that. I think it's definitely a move in the right direction in my mind, but that doesn't mean that it's the be all and end all and it's the absolute answer, because yeah, definitely if it becomes a likability contest, it becomes a commonality contest of like, oh well, whose dad went, well, I know your dad from here and we went to the same school, and it was like, you know, it becomes that, which I don't think is much better. But I do think it's a you know, move in the right direction, just because I really think that like where we are now, I wouldn't say is necessarily better. I guess, to be honest, as you said, it can allow people to discriminate differently, essentially, which is why I feel like more measures need to be put in place. But it's a measure I definitely really agree with, because I just feel like going to work, I say it all the time, I met some of the dumbest people ever. Like, I met some of the most stupid people. That's not just, oh, you know, in terms of how they carried themselves, but just even academically, people that just didn't have to take their studies seriously because they, you know, they knew they'd be fine either way, or they had basically been paid for their whole lives to understand how to perfectly like answer a particular set of questions or whatever. Like, it's just, and like things like, yeah, public speaking, confidence, all those things are like, you know, that are instilled in certain education systems that aren't necessarily prioritized in like the state school system, or like yeah, and like being articulate and stuff like that. So yeah, I do definitely think that it can be, you know, it doesn't remove bias in the same way that people taking like names off of cover letters doesn't remove bias. You still got to turn up to the interview. But I definitely think that just anything that's a move away from the idea that higher education and university education is like the be all and end all in terms of like how you're able to do your job is a really important thing in my mind. But what would the answer be? And I think that's, you know, whoever's job that is, whoever is in that pay grade needs to figure that out, because I feel like, okay, so we remove the university requirement, which would definitely diversify the pool in terms of class backgrounds. But what do we do to still make sure that it's not just you know, a particular type of person that is making it past interview? It's always the interview level in my mind. It's like a big hurdle, because it's that like kind of people searching for like commonality rather than like ability, or yes, just projecting ability dependent on somebody's background.
Absolutely.
So our next topic is going to be on the issues with generational commentary and kind of stereotyping. The conversation that exists generally at the moment around millennials is that, you know, we're all sort of grouped together as being this like afflicted generation that, you know, suffer from crippling rent prices, job instability, and inability to get on the housing ladder and all of that, which is definitely true, and that, you know, those structural problems do exist, but it kind of homogenizes the experience of millennials just generally. Because obviously when you're saying things like, you know, generation rent, it ignores that there are obviously going to be some millennials that aren't affected by those issues. Not all millennials are built the same. And there was an article about this in The Guardian, which was basically talking about, you know, elite, what's the word, millennial landlords, which almost sounds like an oxymoron in itself, but I mean, they do exist. So yeah, it was kind of just talking about the fact that some millennials actually benefit from, you know, how dire the situation is currently. And like, you know, in the same way that there's Generation Rent, they are kind of like able to take advantage of Generation Rent in the same way like any baby boomer landlord would also be able to. And yeah, I guess like it kind of touches on, you know, we had that conversation last week about like speaking about entire groups of people, like really generally, and being like, oh my God, millennials are fucked, when it's like, yeah, the millionaire millennials are nodding along like in it, when in reality, like, you know, they are like renting out to like, they're part of the problem in terms of renting. So what do you think in terms of like how we speak about millennials? I mean, I do think there's a general kind of consensus that we're a screwed generation, but do you think it's okay for people to kind of like, I guess to make it easier, just to call us Generation Rent, when they're obviously going to be some millennials that aren't renting or are actually landlords?
I thought I'm part of the problem. I hate to say it, because I work in advertising, and advertising is based on like grouping everyone together, and people may disagree with that, but that's just basically it. Like, I've spent the last couple of weeks working on a brief that's about Gen Z, and I think I probably know more about Gen Z than I probably like to know, and all of the nuances around what they like, what do they like. So I can't, I guess, in good faith act as if like I don't do it myself, because that's how I guess like it's I agree. I think we have to be able to see what the difference, the different groups and privileges associated with each different group, and we aren't all in this together. I think that is, I think there's, if there's any year that has really shown that we are not all in this together, there are so many deep structural forces at play, which mean that we can never all be in this together. Like, and we should be, but we're not. It's not us against the world. It's us against each other, because we can't even treat the world nicely. Like look at climate change. Like, so for me, I agree with that article. I do think that there is, and I agree with what you were saying, like there is, we need to kind of be a bit more, this whole Generation Rent, yeah. But then we have to acknowledge that there are people really are, the people I've worked with in the past, people that I remember I was speaking to some girl, and she's like, yeah, posh girl from Hertfordshire, whatever. And she, her parents bought her house in Brixton. And I just, do you know where you just think to yourself, we are not the same, like, which would, she, we're both complaining about life and, you know, oh gosh, so tough being a woman and, you know, striving and all that sort of stuff. So tough. Isn't the world so against us? And how do we put ourselves forward? Oh, how do we avoid burnout? And then when it was revealed later on that her parents bought her this flat and she lives with her boyfriend and all that, I actually just thought, wow, I'm in this for myself. What do you think?
I feel like they're allowed to hide behind terms like Generation Rent, which so easily kind of lump us together. And it's like, they don't even have to play victim. Like, we're all playing victim for them, because we're just like lumping together. Like, and this is what I was saying like before about like when we talk about a black community as opposed to black communities, as if we don't all have our like separate experiences, cultures, nuances and everything. I feel confident to speak on behalf of the black community as if I can speak for, you know, a 60-year-old grandmother in Somalia and also, you know, 34-year-old African-American man growing up in Atlanta. And I'm like, yeah, on behalf of these people, this is what I think. I think that's how the millennial conversation is, where it's like, our experiences are very different to other millennials' experiences. And that just should really go without saying. But because, you know, as you said, like advertising, I'm not gonna lie, journalism definitely adds to the, you know, the feeds that same beast by just talking about like millennials, like so generally and stuff. But yeah, I think that just even outside of the millennial conversation, like, of course there are just certain terminologies that make it easier to speak about things. And I think, to be honest, like, yeah, like, that's never going to stop. Like, we use these kind of, like, signifiers and, you know, like, names to, you know, to just be able to conceptualize things easier and, like, have conversations about things. But we just need to be careful, because it can actually absolve things. And also, it's not even necessarily absolving certain behaviors. It just flattens out, and it just leads to less nuanced and kind of engaging conversations about certain things. I'm not gonna lie, same thing with the millennial thing. I've noticed when we have this, when we have private school conversations, yeah, and when we have conversations about like, oh, especially like just harking back to the A-level conversation, it's so funny how many middle class privately educated black people get very, very suspiciously quiet. Like, so many privately educated black people get very quiet when it's like, okay, we're having a conversation about private school, because it's like, I guess when we discuss like how privilege works, it's very, for lack of a better phrase, black and white. And we're very much like, yes, you know, of course, people are, as we know very well, oppressed along racial lines. But people are obviously always oppressed along class lines too. So when you try to have these like nuanced debates about like what oppression is and how it manifests and how it manifests in the school system, like people, a lot of like people online will be very comfortable talking about it in terms of race, but very uncomfortable when you start talking about how the racial element is heavily compounded by a class element. So when they were looking at resits and they were charging like, you know, extortionate prices to resit, that's something that would affect you in terms of class and in terms of money. And I'm like, I was just kind of looking at certain voices like, oh, you're remarkably quiet like when it comes to this. And I feel like that's kind of the generation rent conversation, where it's like, oh, not even generation rent, like the millennial conversation, things that like, yeah, I will see certain, you know, under 30s or like young people that are very vocal on certain things suddenly become really quiet, and it's like, and on other issues, and it's kind of where they don't have the monopoly on oppression. It's like there's certain instances, for instance, that like I can't really relate to, like I'm not gonna talk about it in a particular way because I'd just be lying, I'd be just trying to like, you know, again, like have some monopoly on like oppression and opt into like certain oppressions that I don't experience. But I definitely think there's a real culture of that, because we use these really wide spanning terms like generation rent, doom generation, I might have just made that one up, but like just all these things are all, you know, sandwiched in between recessions. Yeah, those are realities, but it doesn't mean it's affecting everybody in the same way. But I've noticed a lot of people only really like to speak on things that allow them to kind of have a monopoly on disenfranchisement, and when it comes to things that actually kind of reveal their own privileges, because now oppression is a currency in its own, it's in its own way, they just get quiet rather than just owning it. Like, oh, actually, yeah, I'm black, but I also did go to private school, which means that this conversation, yep, I'm still affected in certain ways, but, you know, not in the same way as a lot of other people are. Or, yeah, I am part of Generation Rent, but I actually don't rent. I'm a landlord, so, you know, X, Y, Z. Mm-hmm. They're quiet because it doesn't, it means that they can't write a thread about how fucked everything is. Mm-hmm. So they just don't say anything at all.
Absolutely. I think everybody just wants to be like, I'm fucked and the world is against me, and then it's like, guys, there's different levels to this,
and sometimes
I don't know what it is. I think it's also part of a millennial thing. I hate to be like, oh my god, I'm doing the exact same thing we'll do, but I do think we just sometimes, it's everybody wants to feel like we're all in the same boat. And like, even while I was having a discussion, it's true, I was having a discussion with like my friend, we're talking about online dating, Juba, hi Pam,
oh my god, yet again.
She exactly.
And she's third member of this cast.
She really is. She was saying that, like, yeah, you know, or just roundabout ways, we're talking about colorism and how that affects your dating prospects and all that sort of stuff. This is actual fact. And don't argue with me. Argue with the data. And the lighter you are, the darker you are, the less likely you are to get married. That is not something that we can debate. And so she was just like, yeah, but she was like, but she was seeing her other dark skinned friends, like, you know, get male attention, like she was like, well, they're fine and stuff like that. And I was just like, well, like, colorism is really a big issue, and we were just having the back and forth, and I had to at one point I had to really say to her, like, you're saying this as a woman who, like, I am a dark skin, like, I actually was like, please be aware of the privilege that you're holding to say that my experiences aren't as valid, because, oh, you know,
this is a whole, like, episode in itself, because Pam doesn't identify as light skin. That's a whole other conversation. She doesn't identify as light skin. So
and this is the problem, and it's also me understanding that I'm not as dark as Lupita Nyong'o, so there's different things.
Yeah, there's
play.
Levels to everything.
There's levels to it, and sometimes we don't want to acknowledge these different nuances to our identities, our experiences. And I think that it then it's just, I don't know, the conversation ends up just being very basic and not necessarily progressive and forward looking.
Absolutely. And because that's the thing as well, there are multiple axes of disenfranchisement. So literally, you can be a very dark skinned person, like, say, Lupita Nyong'o, and have better dating prospects, both stunning women, but have better dating prospects than perhaps somebody like Lizzo, who is fucking gorgeous as well, lighter skinned, but bigger. And this is the thing, there are various kind of axes of ways that, like, Was that what I said? Yes, there are various axes of oppression that I think is very... And then when you look at both of them, actually, they're both famous and they're both rich, which then puts them in a more desirable category anyway. And that's the thing. There's various ways in which, like, none of them are going to be perceived in the way that Beyoncé is, because Beyoncé is light-skinned, slim, also thick, like, you know, famous, all these other things as well. But then even someone like Beyoncé will still... I was about to say Beyonce herself is a deity, but if she wasn't, like, just generally, she still will be seen differently compared to, like, other, like, you know, she'll have to strive how many times as hard, or, you know, thrive how many times as hard compared to other white artists that aren't even on her level because of, like, you know, because she's not white. Like, there's just so many different ways in which we can be disenfranchised, and it's funny that we're often only willing to acknowledge the ones that, like, affect us and make us feel the most oppressed, if that makes sense. Because, like, yeah, like, I think even you know that, like, I very much am like, I'm a dark-skinned woman, and it's like, it's only when I came on the internet.
Yeah.
It's literally only when I came on the internet, I was like, oh, right, because people, like, obviously people be like, oh, you're browning, but I've always seen browning as, like, as a kind of, like, I don't want to identify as dark-skinned, so let me call myself a browning, but I was like, no, I'm dark-skinned, that's how I identify, and then it's like, you go on the internet, and it's like, oh, were you ever told that you should hide from the sun because you're going to get a darker tan? Or were you ever told that, like, you know, you're black? And I was like, well, no. And it's like, oh, well, then even though you may feel like you're dark skin, you're not as dark skin as this person to understand this thing. That's the thing. Actually, there's just levels to everything. And there's multiple axes of, like, disenfranchisement. And we kind of need to stop acknowledging these axes as, like, us. It's like a currency, like, oh God, if I admit that I'm privileged in this way, then I can't complain anymore. So then people just don't want to be honest about their situations, because we really don't know how to anymore just care about things without either having, like, a personal, like, you know,
yes,
connection to it, or not even connection, like, personal, like, way of making it, like, about ourselves, or, like, I don't know. There's just so many things. Like, I think I even told you, but this would honestly be a conversation for a whole different episode, that, like, even when it comes to maternal morbidity stats, like, I mean, as someone who's, like, done quite a bit of reading into it, like, it seems to very, very much reflect and disproportionately affect refugee women, like, black refugee women that don't have access to prenatal care. That whole conversation is erased because, like, I don't think people particularly care about black refugee women. And I think, honestly, sometimes that goes for us, like, genuinely, because I feel like a lot of the people that dominate that conversation are less likely to actually be victims of that statistic, because we haven't delved into the black people that it is affecting. And that goes for things like coronavirus. When we're talking about COVID, it's like, yes, like, obviously, as black journalists, as black media people, we have to talk about this, but at the same time, the voices of the people who are most likely to be affected, i.e. key workers, aren't really centered in this conversation. And I think that's just, like, yeah, it's kind of like, so even when it comes to, like, Generation Rent and all this kind of stuff, it is often being written about by people that are not affected by the issues they're talking about, but just have the platform to do so. So, and rather than, you know, using their platform to kind of highlight inequality, they're using it to basically complain and be like, oh, it's so difficult for me because nobody wants to admit to being privileged, because it's like the worst thing. It's like, literally considered the worst thing, or, like, yeah, it's just not something nobody wants admit to. Not at all.
So our Slay of the Week is Little Sims on winning the 2020 Pioneer Award at the, let me say this right, AIMA Awards. Little Sims is someone that, you know, she's just so sick of what she does. So it's always amazing for people, for black women to get the recognition in the music industry that sometimes we don't get enough of. And she's super talented. So it's always amazing and beautiful to see that she's getting that recognition and people are behind her. Can't wait to see what she does next.
Yeah, man. Like, definitely big, big shout out to Little Sims. Like, she's flipping amazing. I interviewed her a couple of years ago and she was lovely, but also just very sort of introspective and interesting. And also just very much like, I don't know how to describe it, like, just above the bullshit. Like, she's just on some next plane. And I think it's sick as well that it's, like, an independent music award that is British, because so much of her love comes from the States and she's supremely underrated here. So it's amazing that she's getting her just desserts. So well done to Little Sims.
So that's it for this episode, guys. Don't forget to subscribe and like and rate and all that good stuff. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys next time.
Till then.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.